Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Laurie Garrett. She's Senior Fellow for Global Health at the Council on Foreign Relations. And we're coming to you from the Council on Foreign Relations headquarters in New York City. We'll be talking to Laurie Garrett about recent international efforts to contain and arrest the Ebola epidemic that continues to rage in Sierra Leone and Liberia in particular and has taken the lives of thousands. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control, or CDC, estimates that in a worst-case scenario, the virus could infect up to 1.4 million cases in Liberia and Sierra Leone by mid-January. However, this estimate does not take into account the actions taken or planned since August or the almost $1 billion U.S. plan to help West African nations contain Ebola. The planned Operation United Assistance calls for the deployment of about 3,000 U.S. military personnel to Ebola-ravaged West Africa, for training of up to 500 healthcare workers per week, building 17 healthcare facilities in the region of 100 beds each, providing home healthcare kits to 400,000 households, and carrying out a home and community-based campaign to train local populations on how to handle exposed patients. The question is, will this effort and those of other countries, NGOs, and the United Nations be enough to break the chain of transmission and begin to reverse the trend? The virus and the inability to contain it has undermined the economic and political stability of affected countries and proved to be more daunting than most expected. We'll speak with Laurie about the many challenges, cultural, political, social, and economic, in addressing what has come to be characterized as not only a humanitarian tragedy, but also a major threat to regional and global security. Laurie Garrett, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, Laurie, we know you're a renowned expert on Ebola. You've written two books, Betrayal of Trust and The Coming Plague. And you've also advised officials in the U.S. government. First, let me ask you, how do you think we got caught off guard this time?
Well, a whole series of mistakes were made. It begins with the fact that the virus appeared in three countries that had never seen Ebola before and that have a different hemorrhagic virus circulating naturally in the background called Lassa fever. And when it appeared in Guinea, the initial diagnosis in this rural area was cholera. So they proceeded as if they were dealing with a cholera epidemic. Of course, cholera is bacterial. You can treat it with antibiotics and oral rehydration, and it's not really contagious without the contaminated fecal matter and so on. So the kinds of precautions you would take were not taken. And then it wasn't until March, so the initial outbreak in Guinea is December, you go all the way to March of this year before there starts to be a recognition this is something much worse, and eventually two laboratories confirm that it's Ebola. By then, it has already crossed in this triangulated juncture area that's all rainforest, where Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea meet. It's already crossed borders. So by then, you're in a situation where no one government can take appropriate action to stop matters. And all three are very weak governments, recently ravaged by civil war, amongst the poorest countries in the world, 50% literacy rates in the populations. So all of this is saying we have a problem and we're not capable of dealing with it on our own. The first big responders to come in were Médecins Sans Frontières or Doctors Without Borders. And from the very beginning, MSF was sending out alerts saying this is much worse than people realize. It's more widespread. It's not localized in one little clinic or one little village area, but rather quite spread out. And at that time, the World Health Organization, meanwhile, had had its budget severely cut, had laid off 20% of its people, and then most recently had had a vote by its legislative body, the World Health Assembly, to completely slash its infectious disease and epidemic response budget because countries thought, well, we don't really need this anymore. And the United States CDC, our Centers for Disease Control, would normally have been able to step into the breach. But the CDC had its own problems. It had a leak in its laboratories in Atlanta of very dangerous pathogens. A mistake was made and some virulent influenza samples were actually shipped in the US mail. All combined, Congress was real mad at the CDC and was calling for firing the director, Tom Frieden, and actually ordered that the special pathogens lab, which is where you would do Ebola work, be shut down pending full investigation. So from late May all the way through to July, the CDC was out of commission in terms of a serious response. And then you hit August, and all of Europe is shut down in August. Mm-hmm. Everybody leaves. You're on the phone, hello, anybody there to help? And there's nobody answering the phones in Europe. So you get all the way to the end of August and the beginning of September before these collective problems start to get shoved aside by the sense of urgency. And everybody starts to realize, you know, MSF is right. This is not like anything we've ever seen before. It's huge, it's urban, it's three countries, it's out of control.
So misdiagnosis, budget cuts, incredulity, all of these different factors. Here we are today, fast forward, President Obama comes out with what is dubbed Operation United Assistance, almost $1 billion, 3,000 military personnel, the building of a land bridge, the deployment of healthcare workers. What is your assessment, Laurie, of this plan? Is it having an impact already? It's going to take a while to ramp up, but we don't have much time. What's your assessment of the implementation?
The problem is that from the very beginning, the U.S. knew whatever we were committing as a government had to be augmented by very serious commitments from other countries. For one thing, our military is distracted by many other issues at the moment. Also, there was this sort of unspoken understanding among the big donors that Guinea had been a French colony, so France should be assisting Guinea. Sierra Leone had been a special colonial outpost of Great Britain, so the UK should handle that. And Liberia had been populated by former American slaves, and we'd always had a special relationship with Liberia. So the US announcement was really, for the most part, about Liberia. So from the very beginning, it was understood, no matter how large the U.S. commitment would be, if the U.K. didn't step up to the plate for Sierra Leone and France didn't step up to the plate for Guinea, the virus would continue to circulate in the region. Since then, the problem is that the U.S. commitment's up here, the World Bank's up here with money, and then you drop way down the chart before you start seeing the next tier of commitments. On a per capita basis, the grandest commitment made is 461 doctors and nurses from Cuba. The combination of MSF and U.S. operatives will have a huge impact in Liberia. The Cubans have gone to Sierra Leone, where there's a much more modest background of commitments by other institutions. The real problem is, regardless, nothing's moving fast enough to get us ahead of the virus. We already need at least 3,000 hospital beds. And at the pace of production of new hospital beds and staffing for those beds, we're only up to about 1,500. So we're already halfway behind the virus. And at the rate that the virus is spreading and the difficulty we're having in getting education properly understood and programs implemented for separating the sick from the well so that spread stops, since we don't have a vaccine, we don't have a drug, we don't have anything, the only way to stop it is to take the sick and remove them from the well. Well, at this point, things are going so slowly on that front that unless we see a dramatic change in the next 14 days, we will be looking at 200,000 cases by the end of November, 400,000 by Christmas, and well over that by January.
So you think the CDC's prediction by January, we may not be able to get ahead of that?
I think it's a race, and right now the virus has the lead by a full lap.
What about in terms of coordination? Is the U.S., with its large military presence, seen as the lead coordinator?
No.
Okay, so talk about who's coordinating. So I imagine that that's an important matter.
The good news is that we had the opening of the United Nations Security Council season, if you will, and then the General Assembly. And the Security Council entertained a resolution regarding Ebola, declaring it a national security threat for all the nations on the planet and calling for a massive mobilization by countries. It was passed by the largest majority of any resolution in the history of the United Nations. 130 nations immediately signed to it. And the following day, Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of the UN, requested from the General Assembly permission, if you will, to be essentially the leader of the whole response and to create an office inside of the Secretary General's office that will be the command center for all the response for the region. So what we have going on now is, yes, there are several different local commands. MSF has their local command post. The United States military has moved a major general from AFRICOM into Monrovia, where he has set up a command post for all our military operatives. The German government recently announced that 2,000 members of the German military have volunteered. But ultimately, everything is being coordinated out of New York by United Nations headquarters.
How have the local authorities responded, whether it's the government in Liberia, the government in Sierra Leone and Guinea in particular? I'm sure they're very welcoming of the help. Are they doing their part in your view, or do they pose impediments?
Well, I'm sure it comes as no surprise that a lot of African states are very weak when it comes to actual governance, actually being able to respond to an emergency within the society. And that's even more the case if they're very poor, if they have a history of brutal civil war, and if there's a tremendous amount of inherent distrust within the population against governance, distrust based on years of civil war. In Liberia, the president has dismissed several cabinet members because they fled the country, abandoned their people. The leaders of all three countries were slow to appreciate the infectiousness of this virus. I don't think they can be blamed for that, though, because obviously WHO was telling them there was nothing to worry about. And most developing countries depend very heavily on what WHO tells them to do.
Well, I want to touch on something you just mentioned, that there's a lot of distrust of governments. These were war-torn societies. There's a lot of fear and suspicion of authorities. So to what extent does this continue to perpetuate the inability of getting this epidemic under control? Because some people are afraid, they don't believe what the government is saying, the severity of the problem, they don't abide by the quarantines. I mean, is this starting to change through education campaigns and sensitization?
I think it's been very hard for outsiders to appreciate how difficult it is to get health messages out, especially ones that are repugnant. They would be here. Just try to imagine in New York City that we had an epidemic of something that was incurable, for which there was no vaccine, and where the only way of protecting all 8.5 million New Yorkers would be to barge into the apartments and homes where we thought there was infection, remove your children from you, remove your husband, your wife from you, your grandmother, and so on, and take them to a quarantine facility. And if they die, deny you the right to be at a burial and to do proper ceremonies to pass them on. Well, that's what's going on. Now, you add to it that you're asking people who don't have a sense of the germ theory of disease. So you're asking people who can't read to understand what a virus is. But this is not what disease is in most of these cultural settings. Disease is about evil spirits, and it's about something you or your family did or your ancestors did to tick off that guy over there who then conjured spirits to make you sick. Now, you've just come out of a civil war, so just about everybody has reason to believe that somebody is mad at them. If you add to that that you've got both the local responders and the foreigners are wearing these outer space suits and they're coming in looking very frightening, sort of our 21st century version of the beaked, robed 14th century responders to the plague. Well, needless to say, this has been met with terrible resistance in many places. At one point, MSF had to abandon one of its clinics when it came under siege. And most recently in Guinea, 8 Guinean health educators were stoned to death and their throats slit by villagers who objected and said, "You've come here to make us sick, not you've come here to teach us how to stay well."
For that very reason, I would like to know to what extent among the teams that are there, health workers, the military, there are anthropologists, others who understand these very real cultural factors, the fears born of the, you know, mistrust of the government. Are they being incorporated into the process?
There has been a call by some anthropologists to, in fact, bring more anthropology into the process. But, you know, I think what you need to step back and think about carefully is, let's just say we focus on Liberia for a moment. The Civil War was so brutal that Charles Taylor's forces kidnapped little boys and taught them to go into villages and chop off the arms and legs of grandmothers. And that only ended 10 years ago. Everybody in every village old enough to have been a cognizant human being 10 years ago lives today with suspicion and concern about the other people who may just be down the road. You're asking for a kind of coordinated response that somehow can overwhelm this, somehow forget this history. It's also important to remember, it's not just that the people are afraid. The individuals executing the programs are afraid, and they have good reason to be fearful. Even if their job is to go in and remove ailing children and take them to a clinic, if a child bites them, kicks back, breaks their protective covering, they can get infected. The police are fearful. They're not even in protective gear, and they're meant to somehow maintain law and order. My great fear is that we're going to see collapse of law and order in these societies as more and more of the police become fearful, don't want to do their jobs, or die off themselves.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Laurie Garrett, Senior Fellow for Global Health at the Council on Foreign Relations. And I'm Carol Castiel. We're coming to you from the Council on Foreign Relations headquarters in New York City. This is a reminder that Press Conference USA is also available online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. And as always, we love to hear from you. Please send your feedback on guests and topics to PCUSA@voanews.com. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or keep up with me on Facebook. And here's a shout out to a faithful listener, Mirza Zahid Baig from Karachi, Pakistan. Well, back to you, Laurie Garrett. You're painting really a very bleak picture, which is only realistic. So let me get back to you on, you know, donors and people stepping up to the plate. This is a global problem. What about neighbors, oil-rich Nigeria? Nigeria had one or two cases. They have been able to contain that, Senegal. But I'm talking about the oil-rich countries like Nigeria, Angola. Do you see the neighbors looking after their brethren to some extent? Are they coming in with funds or their own healthcare workers or psychologists, anthropologists? And I have another question. What about the oil-rich Arab states as well? What do we know about their contributions?
From the very beginning, there was some concern, obviously, in West Africa, in the whole regional neighborhood. And when one Liberian individual flew infected to Lagos and in a very ugly series of scenes infected a large number of other people, including his healthcare workers trying to help him, and some of those healthcare workers, especially one particularly well-known female physician, died of Ebola as a result. Well, obviously, Nigeria took this very seriously. And there was a kind of wall off the region response. I think a lot of Africa thought, if we can just kind of build a trade wall and a movement wall around these three countries, it won't go any further. And one of the key elements of the United Nations resolution that was passed by the Security Council was to condemn countries that, you know, are stigmatizing, that was the phrase, infected nations, and that trade blockades and so on are not appropriate. I think if this virus gets out of these three countries into a major metropolis elsewhere on the African continent, whether it's Nairobi or Lagos or Port Harcourt or Dakar, any of these places, it will have huge ramifications. It will take the whole problem to another level. You'll see nations all over the world responding, often in very bad ways.
But that is precisely why I'm asking if Nigeria, in order to forestall such a thing, is coming up with some funds. I mean, they certainly have them. The fact that there's a lot of corruption there shouldn't be the impediment. I mean, if they are so concerned that it could affect Lagos and other large cities, you would think that whether it's Nigeria or Angola, with the huge resources and revenues, is there any sense of solidarity in the sense that, no, we don't want it to come here, so therefore we're going to help you? And even the Arab countries, they're so wealthy. I'm just wondering who's stepping up to the plate. We know it's the United States. We know some European countries, and of course, WHO, CDC, and so on. But I want to know about these other actors.
The African Union has committed 30 responders who are going primarily to Sierra Leone. A few of the Emirates have put some modest sums, a million here, a couple million there, into the pot, and also allowed a lot of the flights that were going in, delivering supplies and so on, to route through their airports, which was a big deal, especially a month ago when no commercial flights were getting in and it was getting to be almost impossible just to get volunteer doctors in and out. It's a little better now that the U.S. Air Force has built a so-called air bridge connecting Accra Airport through smaller flights to targeted sites within the three countries.
And this is for the purpose of supplies and healthcare workers. Mm-hmm.
But I think we have yet to see the kind of
solidarity.
The kind of solidarity you would like to see featured from the MENA region and sub-Saharan Africa.
Well, I ask that because, you know, at the end of the day, the international community, of course, is indispensable. But as you said earlier, we got caught off guard. Budgets were cut. People misdiagnosed the initial outbreak. But still yet, it's going to be these countries have to eventually take control of their societies, the health infrastructure, which is very weak to begin with. And the other concern, of course, is all these resources going in to contain Ebola. There's still a lot of other diseases, whether it's malaria, typhoid, and other diseases maybe which aren't being treated. So what is the impact Ebola is having on these diseases?
If you take a worst case scenario, and I just want to be very clear about this, this is worst case, not what will happen. But if you take a worst case scenario right now, you're looking at 1.4 million infections by the end of January, which would translate, given the mortality rate of roughly 70%, into upwards of 900,000 dead. It also means, and this is already happening, that every single hospital bed in these three countries is just an Ebola bed. So you have to add to that death toll people dying from car accidents, from injuries that might otherwise have been treatable, women dying in childbirth, children going untreated for acute episodes of malaria, untreated Lassa fever, on and on and on, so that every heart attack, every cerebral malaria episode becomes a lethal experience because there's no health system in place whatsoever. So the true cost of this in just human lives lost could be well over a million people. And that's, by the way, in just two of the countries. Those numbers are only Liberia and Sierra Leone combined. They don't even include Guinea, much less the possibility that between now and January, this spreads into other nations.
The current state of flights going in and out of Liberia, Sierra Leone, Guinea, are all commercial flights canceled?
There are a couple of commercial carriers that are still willing to go in. They've greatly reduced their number of flights, but for the most part, supplies are getting in through special provisions set up by the United States Air Force in conjunction with the governments of Senegal and Ghana.
Well, Laurie, as we conclude, your observations or what do you think are the biggest challenges right now that have to be addressed in order for us to forestall this worst-case scenario that you've painted?
Look, first of all, the amount of everything that's been promised falls far short of what is needed. Secondly, most of it's not moving fast enough. It's not getting from the promise to the reality state fast enough. We need far more volunteers with medical training willing to go and work in the area, even for a few weeks. We need far more personnel, more supplies, more everything. And the world has to be willing to make sacrifices on a rapid humanitarian scale. The problem, of course, is we're distracted by many other things. The same breath could be talking about ISIS, could be talking about the Syrian ongoing crisis, could be talking about the floods in northern India, or the list is huge. And the hard part is to make people understand this is different because it is by definition growing. That's the nature of an epidemic. So whatever you think are the true numbers today are already irrelevant tomorrow. This isn't trying to contain some small band of thugs somewhere. This is a virus, and it's spreading. And we're still in the early stages of an epidemic where even if we did mobilize sufficiently right this minute, it would still be weeks before we would have the matter shrinking.
And any message for our listeners, particularly those in sub-Saharan Africa, who maybe would like to do something, volunteer, or be somehow useful in their communities?
Many different organizations have websites to which you can sign up and offer whatever skills and talents or cash or supplies you're prepared to pony up. Our United States Agency for International Development has a new website up just for ideas. If you have a solution, if you have something you've invented, a technology, some sort of an approach that you think can make a difference, USAID now has a place for you to send that in and let them know. The idea that makes the difference just might come from somebody living in a country that is landlocked deep in the interior of Africa. That just might be the person that knows what to do.
Laurie Garrett is Senior Fellow for Global Health at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York City. Laurie Garrett, thank you so much for your insights.
Thank you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in New York City and Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Gary Jaffe. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.